next speaker is almost certainly a spy who was taught German at school in the Cold War by John le Carré. You might also accuse me of nepotism in asking him to speak, but in fact, as you all know, nepos in Latin means grandson or nephew, so there's nothing wrong in asking my dear dad to speak. He was head of Margaret Thatcher's policy unit, editor of TLS, and author of 30 books, including Cold Cream and Kiss Myself Goodbye, The Many Lives of Aunt Monka. Always good to have a serial liar in the family. And his newest book is Big Caesars and Little Caesars, How They Rise and How They Fall, from Julius Caesar to Boris Johnson.
Thank you very much. Your name should be familiar to me. But,
Close to your mouth, right.
Here we are. It's a great honour to be the father of the editor of the LD. It's an honorary office, carries no salary. You get the occasional free lunch and kind review in the pages of the LD. What more can you ask?
Closer to the mouth.
So it's extremely nice to be here. And wonderful that Alan pointed out the extraordinary thing about the novels of my old German master at school is that there are no jokes in them. And he was the most humorous and amusing teacher I've ever had or could ever wish to have. So it was a brilliant exercise of professional discipline. He kept all the laughs out of those wonderful novels. To move on to today's business, I've been very daunted by my neighbours on both sides have said that as soon as they see somebody pick up a sheet of paper, their heart sinks. Well, I'm undaunted, and because of the threat of aphasia, I've picked it up, and here I am. And what I want to start is by recalling Karl Marx's famous wisecrack, is that when the philosopher remarked that everything in history happens twice, he forgot to add the first time as tragedy, the second time as farce. And what he was talking about, as you may also remember, was the violent coup d'etat by Louis Napoleon in 1852, in which he proclaimed himself the Emperor Napoleon III and the new Caesar. In Marx's eyes, this comic mountebank had no hope. Victor Hugo called him Napoleon le Petit. Well, Louis Napoleon had the last laugh on both of them. Victor Hugo had to spend the next 20 years in exile, and actually Napoleon III was really, for most of his time, rather successful until he got involved in a couple of stupid foreign wars. But Marx's line, and this was tremendously fashionable at the time, is that Caesars were anachronism, a throwback. In the modern world, they had no place. And yet, Napoleon III reigned for 22 years. And if Marx had been able to look forward to the 20th century, what would he have seen? A bunch of horrible, self-proclaimed Caesars who murdered millions and launched the most terrible wars imaginable. And then this illusion didn't die, because more than 100 years later, 1989, the American philosopher, very fashionable at the time, Francis Fukuyama, proclaimed the end of history. History is over. In future, there's nothing but nice, quiet, liberal democracies. There's no scope for strong men or Caesars. That's all dead. But as we look around us today, what do we see? Strong men everywhere. The big Caesars, little Caesars, big countries, small countries, throwing their weight about, strutting their stuff, or waiting in the wings after they've been chucked out, waiting to come back again. This morning I see that Donald Trump is the hot favourite to become the next American president. Well, right up to the last minute, we believed it couldn't happen here, couldn't happen to us now. We were too wide awake, too clever. But here they are, and in numbers. But of course, why should this surprise us so much? Dictators have been an ever-lurking threat throughout history. And they interrupted and betrayed the constitutional traditions of ancient Greece and the Roman Republic. By the time of Thucydides and Plato, the word tyrannos, which had started out as a perfectly neutral word for king, it had already become our modern pejorative sense of tyrant. So it's an uncomfortable thought that Caesars may pop up anywhere, anytime, under any sorts of conditions. So what I'm trying to do in this book is to identify the tricks and techniques common to all Caesars, big and little. When I say big Caesars, I don't mean that they're in any way greater or superior. I just mean many of them have been monsters, as you know. What I mean is that their violence, their law-breaking, their lying, are on a huge, often limitless scale, whereas little Caesars are content to go as far as they need to, break the law or introduce new repressive laws, tell lies, fix the judges, chuck people out of parliament, close down parliaments, all the rest of it, all the things we know so well. So it's what they have in common that I'm concentrating on. And I'll start with the lying. Every would-be Caesar has his own alternative narrative. For 2 millennia, Julius Caesar's Gallic Wars, which I'm sure many of you were taught at school, been taught by schoolmasters as an absolute model of military history, limpid, economical, and true. And it's only in the last 20 years, 2,000 years later, that scholars all over the world have suddenly woken up to the fact that Julius Caesar might have made a lot of it up. Yet even at the time, this rather remarkable figure, Gaius Asinius Pollio, who was a general, a playwright, and all sorts of things, and he was a Caesar supporter, and he served alongside Caesar and crossed the Rubicon with Caesar. And he said, according to Suetonius, actually, Caesar's memoirs were put together somewhat carelessly and without strict regard for truth. So, you know, they knew it at the time, but they kept it dark. Napoleon's bulletins from the battlefield were equally boastful and unreliable. To lie like a bulletin became a catchphrase in France. Early on in his military career, there's a particularly ripe example on the bridge at Arcola. It was his iconic victory in his second Italian campaign. According to the legend, Napoleon seized the flag from the standard bearer, stormed the narrow bridge under a hail of Austrian bullets, and the scene was immortalized in all sorts of paintings and engravings, famously in Antoine Jean-Gros' Bonaparte at the Bridge of Arcola. What actually happened was that Bonaparte started across the bridge with the flag, but his troops refused to follow him, and the French forces were driven back from the river by Austrian fire. In the chaos of the retreat, he was shoved into a ditch up to his neck in water and nearly drowned. Two other generals had to be sent to take Arcola from the rear. Nobody crossed the bridge. Yet this was the legend which completely dominated France in the 19th century. Checking up Donald Trump's lies has become something of a cottage industry for fact-checkers. The Washington Post team, didn't seem to have anything better to do than to add them all up. They recorded 30,573 untruths uttered by Donald Trump during his presidency, which works out at about 21 lies a day. The most serious example, of course, which we all know, repeated ad nauseam, that he won the 2020 election. We won big. And the election was stolen from him from systematic and widespread voter fraud. What's less well known is that Trump has been in this game for years. 8 years earlier, on the night of Obama's re-election, Trump tweeted, "We can't let this happen. We should march on Washington and stop this travesty. He lost the popular vote and claims to have won the election. We should have a revolution in this country." Exactly the same things he was saying 8 years later. These last two tweets were later deleted, but in the wonderful permanence of the IT universe, there, of course, they couldn't get rid of them. So we know that he was lying then and lied later. Boris Johnson was first sacked at the age of 23 from the Times for making up stuff. When he became Brussels correspondent for the Telegraph, he sent back a wonderful stream of confections and exaggerations about the EU's plans, that they were about to ban prawn cocktail crisps, that British sausages would be outlawed, that condom sizes were to be standardised because Italian men had smaller penises. None of these, you know, we can't help laughing even now. None of these things ever happened, of course. But their combined drift was to convince the British public, or a large part of it, that the EU was out to standardise everything in the British way of life. When he became first a standard bearer for the cause of Brexit and then Tory leader and Prime Minister, he carried on where he left off. The worst lie, and the one still causing grievous problems, was the pledge that there would be no customs check or controls between Great Britain and Northern Ireland, which was completely implausible after his revised deal with the EU in October 9, 2019. And finally, after my little book went to press, he was driven out of Parliament by his serial lying to Parliament about Partygate, something which we are still kind of numbed by. We can't really imagine this could happen to a Prime Minister, but it did. But what they all share, our Caesars, big and little, is a contempt for Parliament and all its traditions. Napoleon I smashed up Parliament not once, but three times in the coups of Vendémiaire, Fructidor and Brumaire to prevent elected royalist majorities from running the show. But we here in England have our own homegrown Caesar, who outperformed even Napoleon in the breaking up of parliaments. As you cross the road in Parliament Square towards the Houses of Parliament, the first figure you see is this statue, Oliver Cromwell, 1599 to 1658. There he is with his sword and his Bible and the British lion recumbent at his feet. The question, though, is why is he there? Why does Cromwell get such pride of place? Because, after all, the one thing we all know about Cromwell is that he's famous for smashing up Parliament and seizing the mace. But what we may often forget is that he didn't smash up Parliament once. He did it six times. 1648, 1653, 1654, 1655, 1656, 1658. Every time there was a hostile majority, he came in and closed it down. And he didn't develop much respect for the law when he was in power. He referred to Magna Carta as Magna Fata and the Petition of Right as the Petition of Shite. Using rough language is another trick of the Caesar's trade, to intimidate more sensitive souls such as you and me. Remember how Boris Johnson repeatedly set out to discredit Theresa May's deal with the EU by describing her efforts as like polishing a turd. This wasn't just sort of a passing remark to a journalist. He said that repeatedly in a cabinet meeting at Chequers just to frighten them. Sooner or later, any modern Caesar will have a go at bashing up Parliament, attacking the High Court judges who are thwarting him, Trump, Orban, Netanyahu. Think what's happening in Israel at the moment. Half the professional classes, the pilots, all the representatives of established society in Israel they're virtually on strike, saying that Netanyahu must not be allowed to neuter the Supreme Court. But you'll have a very good go, and I've got 1 minute left, and I really haven't got anything else much to say, except that this book is also about why Caesars fail, about why coups flop, and how Caesars can be unhorsed by resolute and ingenious opponents banding together. Look back, and this is one of the most remarkable and interesting things about the past 2 years. The United States Congress has twice impeached a president who broke the law and then refused to accept the verdict of the voters. In the UK Parliament, Conservative MPs have deposed a prime minister who repeatedly broke every rule of conduct. In Brazil, the voters threw out the overweening Jair Bolsonaro. If we live in a new age of Caesars, we also live in an age of Caesar toppling. They can be frustrated. Public officers who do their duty as they did in Arizona and Georgia can stop him in his tracks. So can Tory MPs with a conscience. Yes, they do exist. Or American election officials, even if they have the President of the US breathing down the claim their necks. Despite the claims of the Emperor Augustus, Caesars are not living gods. They are very, very mortal. Thank you very much. Thank you.